Hello and welcome to the In Context podcast. This is an exciting time for me today. I've got a new friend on the podcast today. It's Jamie Jones Buchanan, MBE. You don't mind me mentioning that bit, do you, brother?
All good.
Awesome. Brilliant. Jamie, would you mind explaining a little bit about who you are and what it is you do at this moment in time?
Jack of all trades, master of none, still looking and finding my gifts and talents and trying to develop them. Ultimately, I guess my job title, my main job and role is director of culture diversity and inclusion at the Leeds Rhinos, a rugby club that's been my cultural home for nearly 30 years now, nearly three decades. And the reason being, I used to support Leeds Rugby League before they were known as the Rhinos from being about 9 years old. I'd go there most weekends when they played at home and I was inspired, educated and entertained by what I saw. That informed me as to who and what I wanted to be, which is a professional rugby league player. I knew from an early age, we might get into the reasons why, that sport was going to be influential to me. It was going to be the vehicle on which I lived my life. I was fortunate to sign for Leeds as a 15-year-old fanboy way back in 1997. And if I'd have played just one game, I'd have been over the moon. That'd have been a dream, but I was really looking that I played 421 games over the course of about 20 years. I became known as what's referred to now as the golden generation of players who occupied the time we call the golden decade. We had a great deal of success, a lot of adversity. And when I retired 5 years ago in September of 2019, I did do with a great sense of gratitude for what opportunities the game of rugby league, the sport, and the Leeds Rhinos and the people of Leeds had given me. I went into coaching for 3 years. And I loved that. I had an interim head coach role for 6 weeks when the head coach left, and it was the most terrifying, exhilarating, educating 6 weeks of my life. It was outstanding. But at that time as well, I also understood that I loved people more than the game, and there was a multitude of reasons to stay connected with people. So when this opportunity came up to be director of culture diversity and inclusion, which is ultimately looking after all the people at the club and telling the stories to the community, I grabbed it with both hands. As you probably come to be aware, I like storytelling. I prefer to listen to them, by the way, more than I like telling them. So I'm also a pundit on Sky. Doing a fair bit of Sky. I've been doing that for about 3 years. Got my own media production company called Round Films, where we try and document stories. Actually, my favourite place to be is behind the camera and seeing stories unfold. And I'm chair of a couple of boards, inclusion board at RFL. I'm a board observer at RFL, and just try to learn and help facilitate that governance piece around creating environments for people to thrive. So lots of little bits going on, but ultimately it's about people. We're in the people business, and it's a real blessing.
Awesome. Sounds very busy, and you're also husband and father.
Yes, absolutely. We often get distracted by what we do. My biggest treasure and gift in life is my wife. I met my wife, Emma, when I was about 14 years old. I'm 43 now, so she's my best mate. And we got married in about 2008, come back from a World Cup playing for England. We've got four boys who are wonderful. They are really good lads. They're called Lord, Axe, Kurgan and Bane. Different names. I was a Star Trek fan when I was a kid. and they're currently nearly 18, 17, 15 and 11. I say nearly because oldest two got the birthdays in the next week. And they're sort of transitioning into the next chapter of their life. So the oldest two have just left school, went to college. One of them's studying criminology. One of them's got a building college. And they're really turning into young adult men. So being a dad's really important to me. Interesting upbringing. I don't know if you want to go back there, but I had a lot of love when I was growing up. I absolutely can't complain about that. The sort of patriarchal side of it. My father, my biological dad left when I was about, I don't know, maybe a year, 18 months. And my stepdad who brought me up, he was in the Navy, so he was obviously away quite a lot. A lot of the male role models that I had came through playing sport and elite sport. So being a dad for me is a new education and something that's really important.
Awesome. Yeah, similar for me. When I became a Christian, I not only struggled to know how to be a Christian father because I didn't have any Christian role models growing up, I didn't even have a father as a role model growing up. So, yeah, that was a new journey for me. And by the grace of God, I've managed to muddle through it, and thankfully that my girls have been patient enough to practice on them. Yeah. Oh, so just share a little bit about your upbringing then, because I'm fascinated to see how working class men can thrive, overcome obstacles, and achieve their dreams and targets. And it sounds very much so you've exceeded your dreams. You said you would have been happy to play one game for Leeds Rhino, but you've seemed to have had a lifetime there in numerous different roles. So just share a little bit about your upbringing, what that looked like, and what working class meant for you.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of that recently, thinking about my origin story. I think it's really important whenever you're telling a story about who you are to reflect on who you've been and where you've come from. And for me, grew up in a small working class town called Bramley in West Leeds. It's an interesting demographic. It is very white working class, and it hasn't changed much in the time that I've been here. And it's interesting. I actually really like it. I still live here now. I have no aspirations to move away from it, and I live about 100 metres away from the house I lived in when I signed for Leeds as a 15-year-old. I'm 43 now. And home is home, and majority of my family's here. But my dad, as I mentioned there, is of a Caribbean heritage, St. Kitts. He was born in the UK, but his parents would have been a part of that Windrush generation. Came over way back when. He met my mum, who's a white girl from Leeds. Her father's Welsh in the Jones, Welsh descendant Jones in that. So I'm obviously dual heritage, mixed race. And early on as a young kid, and I reflect on this photograph that I've got, I was always really big for my age. And I always talk about the fact that statistically, it's quite unusual because I was born on the 1st of August. And if you don't know, there's something called the relative age effect, where those children who are born in June, July, August, the youngest in the year. So when it comes to PE and physical exercise, any type of sport, because they're the smallest in the year, at sort of 5 or 6 years old, they often don't excel at the physical activities because they've just not had time to grow. Not that they've not got potential, but everybody's aware of whose birthday is when, you're not quite sure, you all just get put in one pot. And you end up with these limiting beliefs. Oh, I'm not good at sport, therefore I'm not going to try. I'm not good at sport. And it's not that you're not good, but I was lucky that I was massive. And even though only 13% of professional rugby league players were born in June, July, August, the fact that I was big was advantageous to play in a gladiatorial game. I was well coordinated. I was always strong, powerful. And I used to win a lot as a kid. So that's a great way to make friends, right? So when you're playing a sport, people want you to be on their team. You're sharing success together, and that's a galvanising, bonding experience. And that's why I love the sport. My dad moved away. He's got 11 kids, my dad, think about 5 different women. And the funny story I always tell is his youngest 2 girls, if they come out of my house and visiting, I have to tell my boys to go look after their aunties, which become quite confusing. Dad's surname is Buchanan. My mum's maiden name was Jones, hence the double barrel name, because they were only 18 when they had me. Couldn't decide which name to keep, so they kept them both. I didn't have the same name as my mum or dad in its totality. I know it's a silly story that when I made my debut for Leeds, I went in changing rooms hoping to see Jones Buchanan out back in my shirt, knowing that my family would be out in the stands, both sides, family, friends. But the time they couldn't fit the full name on it, so they cut it down to Jones. And to make it even worse, the kit man, whose job it was to put the names on the back of the kit, in his infinite wisdom, he put Jones on home shirt and Buchanan on away shirt, which was even more confusing. So I, obviously having a double barrel name, become synonymous. I didn't need much introduction. Stood out like a sore thumb, especially when I got the beard. But as a kid, yeah, I knew sport was going to be a place where I was going to make friends, occasionally within the rules, get back at my enemies. And it ultimately, as we talk about faith, became my primary identity. Almost to a point where it was idolatrous, you know, it would be all and end all. And winning was absolutely king to me as a kid, because I thought, if I lose, then I'm going to lose everything that comes with it, as in friendships and purpose and belonging. So, yeah, sport was a big driver, but it also had a lot of good lessons as well. It helped me to learn how to win, how to lose, how to make friends, how to play as a team, how to have perseverance, discipline, and all the other things that feed into good sports people.
Awesome. So I grew up in Middlesbrough, which is similar to Leeds, very big working class town, as opposed to a large city. We're a lot smaller than Leeds, but similar demographics and culture to a lot of Leeds. And I know many men and women who were gifted sports people, but very few made it. They did well, but never reached their full potential. What was it that you think helped you, coming from a working class background, to achieve your dreams and beyond?
I think the primary word would be opportunity. So when I actually reflect now, you know, the fact that I was born on 1st of August in this particular part of the world, mixed race, I think at the minute, and I didn't realise it this until I started this role in culture, diversity, inclusion, that about 6.5% of the rugby league community game is non-white, and only 13% of the professional game. And that's supplemented by the South Sea Islanders, obviously Polynesian lads. So really, it's not very diverse at all, but it is very inclusive. And by that, I mean, the colour of my skin was never a barrier for me playing rugby league, as far as I can tell. Now, was there some prejudice? Maybe, perhaps. The fact that I grew up in a white working class community meant that that was just completely all normal to me. You know, it's never intimidating. A lot of people now might say, well, they do say, I've asked the question, why don't you play rugby league? Well, because there's nobody there that looks like me. Yeah. And whilst that's true, I would still invite those individuals from those communities to still come and knock, because I'm sure you'd find the game extremely welcoming. And lots of proof in that as well. But for me, to answer your question, it comes down to opportunity. And that's why I've got this real sense of gratitude and desire to pay forward whatever's in my power, using the resource and facilities I've got, to try and create an environment that provides opportunities for people of all ages and abilities. And now, in 2024, it's not just one men's team like it was when I signed for Leeds. We've got a women's team, very good by the way, played at Wembley in the Challenge Cup final again this year. We've got a wheelchair rugby team who just won the Grand Final two Sundays ago against the Halifax Panthers. And look, I don't want to lean too much on winning. Sometimes it's just about being inclusive and enjoying themselves. But they've worked really hard for that. I think the first 3 years they lost every game. We've got a physical disability team. So, you know, men have been, some of which have been blown up in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, missing limbs, eyes, but still find a community to play a great game of rugby league. Got a learning disability team. Also got a netball team and a running club. So it's about bringing all those people together and giving them opportunities. And I'll say this just really quick, not to keep going, because I love this subject. It's questions I ask myself all the time. But a good friend of mine who was part of that golden generation called Rob Burrow sadly passed away this year after a 4.5 year battle with motor neuron disease. And this Pablo Picasso quote stuck out that I saw in a gallery. And it said, the meaning of life is to find a gift. The purpose of life is to give it away. And the truth is the truth. Truth is never fragile. And it's really easy to sort of cross-pollinate that into biblical messages. And even right at the outset of the Bible, in the beginning, first things first, God, the main character protagonist, the character around which the whole Bible is about, created God, the heavens and the earth. And then there's this, let there be light, separating the light from the dark, the night from the day, bringing order to chaos. And not long after, we found that we're made in his image, we're made male and female. And there's just this realization to me that we've got to create a God. And I think where we find most joy, or a lot of joy in life, is when we are being creative, especially when it's communal. And even if you go in a little bit later on in the Bible, we're talking about the body of Christ and all having the same job, different roles. You know, we all try, we're all worshiping God. We're preparing for his kingdom and living in a way that glorifies him, but each with a different gift, or in service. And we've all got different roles to play. And it's such a blessing when somebody can find what they're good at and nourish it over time. Use it, some of the metaphors around mustard seeds growing into something huge. You know, unlike superheroes, we're not born with a superpower, but I believe everybody's got a superpower inside them if they can find it and an opportunity to grow it. And sport is just one of many ways to do that, but it's just easier to measure because it's physical and it's really easy to build metrics around sport. It's easy to follow, but you know, it could be a speaker, it could be somebody who creates content. You could be somebody who just walks into a room and makes everybody laugh. Everybody's got something different to give. But, you know, to quote Ecclesiastes, it's meaningless without God at the centre of it. And from an eternal perspective, it's what and who are you using that gift for?
Awesome. Yeah. Fantastic. And again, you mentioned briefly when we first started about your always new sport was your gift. Who was your main encourager in that? Was that just something that you knew you were good at, or did you have role models around you pushing you and encouraging you to achieve your sport?
I had a lot of role models. So because I sort of leaned into sport because I was good at it. And I believe everybody. I think there's a book called The Good Life, and it's a longitudinal study. And it talks about, you know, when people are on the deathbed and they reflect on their life, what are the most important factors in the foxhole, in the proverbial foxhole, right? It's having a purpose and meaning. Second is belonging. So you belong somewhere, you want to be part of a group. Then physical and mental well-being. And for me, when I knew I was good at sport, I had something to give. And then within the context of a team, to give it away. And bestowal is really important. So we'll maybe talk about love in a bit. Now, God is love. In the Gospel of John, I love it because it's so metaphorical. It's so rich and abstract, but it all revolves around the emotion of love. But love is almost like a verb. It's a doing. You see the fruits of love in your action, in what you want to do for people. So having that gift and bestowing is a great signal, a great sign as to where your heart is and what it is you're serving. So I found that tribe early on. But then you're always looking for and at people who express the values that you want to be associated with. So when people talk about our mission, vision, values, behaviors, the type of person you want to be, you will be attracted to the people who live like that and express those similar values. It becomes magnetic. And it's really easy then to be signposted by those values into a particular direction so that you don't. It's the narrow path to salvation. When you see these values being exhibited in people, that God willing come through the gospel, come through the Bible, the Holy Spirit, and reading it like on a daily basis, and it becomes part of your subconscious. Those values become who you are. Now, before I knew who God was, before I knew who Jesus was, I looked at role models on the television, in sport, and just to give you a couple of examples, the most influential, you'll like this, influential sporting moment in my life was probably 1990 World Cup when Paul Gascoigne starts crying, you know, the old Pavarotti, Italian 90, and you're looking at a megastar. For the first time in my life, I'm seeing as a nine-year-old what it means to fight tooth and nail for your country and give everything. And these boys did in the semi-final against West Germany, and he's crying his eyes out, and you're thinking, wow, one of my heroes is crying on television. You know, from a sort of male point of view, it made it all right to be emotional. You know, I was like, it's all right, crying, it's fine, it's cool. He did it live on telly, one of the biggest events ever. And then people like actors like Eddie Murphy. Whilst I did look through the lens of white working class community, I think I used to watch Eddie Murphy films back in the day, and he was this standout character that he always seemed to be in a white community. But he was really funny, he was really intelligent. And that's what made him stand out. It shone, and it was a bit abstract and extrovert. And that was inspiring to me. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to live life with that type of richness. And just to give you an insight into my personality, you know, I am a person that sees things in pictures. You know, but life inside my head is quite chaotic. I struggle with order. So schedules, turning up on time, wearing the right kits, never easy. I've got to try and get it down to the lowest common denominator to make it as simple as possible so I don't forget, right? It's almost impossible to get it wrong. But by nature, I am a creative, abstract, colourful type individual.
Awesome. Yeah, I like the Eddie Murphy. All I could think of when we talk about Eddie Murphy was, I've got an ice cream, you haven't got one. So I don't know if you can remember that joke.
Yeah, I mean, everything about it, honestly, it's just, I could, you know, when you put them films on,
yeah,
I could quote nearly all of them. And even now when you go back, and they're so easy to watch. Films in 80, they're just not complicated. You take it for what it is. Every minute's entertaining. And it's inspiring. And I think, look, at the end of the day, you're always trying to grow get out of your comfort zone. And these people are almost nudging you, willing you to be the best version of yourself. If you're talking about inspiring, I don't think you can grow unless you're outside of your comfort zone. And one of the other reasons outside of opportunity why people, I believe, don't thrive is because they're just not happy with being uncomfortable. Because it's just, tomorrow morning, I'll be out doing my interval training. I've got a marathon to run at the end of November. I'm 43 years old. I don't need two marathons. I just carry on doing things that are going to challenge me, going to ask me the right questions, are going to make me reflect on what I put in my mouth, how much training I get done. They're going to help me to try and be the best 43-year-old and then best 45, and entropy and time will get me in the end. But that drive to always strive to try and get a win is what, for me, is important. And I've noticed my camera's gone off. All right.
Yeah, so I don't look very athletic. I'm a bit overweight, quite a lot overweight, some might say. But I love my sport, and gladiatorial is a word that you've used. And giving it all, and you're on about fighting for your country. And I do a bit of catch wrestling and jiu-jitsu, and you sound very much like my coach. And when I go to the gym and someone's trying to crank my neck or snap my arm off, or I feel exhilarated. Again, it's that gladiatorial sport that, I don't know, that testosterone, that creativity in actually not just using your physical strength but your mind in combat is something that when I miss affects me mentally. I'm slower, I'm sluggish, I'm less happy and less energetic. And how have you seen sport impact people from working class communities for the better? Why do you think it's necessary for many men to experience what it's like to be gladiatorial?
I think it's part of our nature to, you know, when you're part of a tribe, you've got to protect that tribe. And a long time ago, that would have had a fair amount of physical expression. You know, the world, even a few hundred years ago, was completely different to what it is now. We're relatively safe. We're living probably, arguably, as much chaos as there is out there. One of the safest times in human history, certainly the most advanced. And certainly for males, I just think it's part of our makeup when it comes to being leaders as well. And there's also an element of, I think, that tribal sort of gladiatorial element helps us to think about our place within that group, and an appreciation for the people we've got around us and those different skills that each one brings. Somebody might be speed, somebody might be strength, somebody might be strategy. And we all sort of tip in. Somebody said, it was in a church sermon recently, actually, it was brilliant. I think they said, I might get it slightly wrong, there's something like 5 million parts in an average aeroplane, but not one of them can fly, right? You put them all together, you've got this amazing machine that's pretty consistent. And I always think about that whenever you're pulling parts and people together. I think you can't be the best version of you without a group around you. It's really important. And what you, I'm assuming, I don't know how long you've been doing jiu-jitsu. A good friend of mine has a Gracie Barha gym in Leeds. I haven't done it yet. And there's a lot of sort of men that sort of, he calls it the next 45, the second chapter, that midlife period where men are often redefining who and what they are and just adjusting where they're going in life. And it can end up catastrophic for many of them. But I just think reconnecting and getting together is a good way for our physical and mental well-being. You, I don't know how long ago you found it, but that, even as a metaphor, the wrestle and the contact, it must almost be a gracious dance at times.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. Yeah, it is. Especially when we're training and we go 50-50, and as we're attacking somebody at 50%, we're giving them an opportunity to defend and vice versa, and it's keeping us sharp. We're not trying to injure each other. We're trying to prepare each other. That tribe thing is very true. So our training partners, our dance partners are equipping us for the enemy, I suppose, for when we go to competition. So then when we do it 100%. But again, when we talk about gladiatorial, when we talk about fighting, some Christians can be put off about martial arts or even about tough sports like rugby and boxing. How can you bring this kind of gladiatorial language into the church and run it alongside you as a Christian, when a lot of people So I have this conflict. I have some friends in the church who think that I can sound too aggressive. Then I have some friends in the gym who think I sound too effeminate. How can you bring together your faith and this the language of gladiators?
I think a lot of it comes out of intent. Mm-hmm. What's your intention? I think when you think about any sport, getting your heart rate up, oxygen into your lungs, sunshine into your eyes, and you're competing. We all know it's irrefutable, like physically, it's absolutely good for you. There's longevity, it helps you to live longer. And it's been done in a multitude of different ways over the years. And again, I think there's this inner need or almost desire. I think sport is a wonderful way of doing that in a controlled facsimile of what would otherwise be an aggression of ill intent. So you know, whenever we compete, you see the emotion, whether it's wrestling and gladiatorial or rugby or even football, you get these tribes of people that wear banners and different coloured kits to be part of a group. And the emotion that boils up at referees, at each other, and it's one big theatre. It's a big theatre. Mm. And instead of having a stage, you've got a field or a court or an arena. And instead of actors, you've got athletes. Instead of a script, you've got rules. Instead of an author, you've got a referee. And we're all just playing out. The difference between the two is you don't know the ending in sport. And that's what makes it exhilarating. You know, we always try to predict as a pundit, this is what's going to happen. He's not playing because he's injured. He's going to be sent off. He should be sent off. And we try and make predictions, and things inspire us by how they re-manifest themselves quite often against the odds. Mate, I've been watching rugby league all the year this year. I don't know if I predicted a game right or all the way through. It's just so competitive, you know. Mm. You're like, wow, how good's this? But be able to pull a narrative out of it and say, well, why don't we fix the gaze on this here and just see what happens and how it plays out. And quite often it's just the strength of character that does. And then but when trials and tribulations hit us in real life, we're somewhat more prepared to deal with it because we've seen that inspirational sportsman or woman come through something else. You know, some of the stuff around Chris Hoy recently really sort of sad. And when you think about him, but then you think about all the inspiration he's given over his sporting career. So listen, I'm not gonna beat around the bush. I sometimes joke about it. I remember once, I always tell the story, I went to a church in Leyland giving a testimony near Wigan, and we'd beaten Wigan not too long before, and I had the Super League trophy. Somebody goes, oh, Christian lad, he said, what about that kid's head? He took clean off his shoulders, give a penalty away. I said, look, I've been told it's more blessed to give than receive. So I try to get it in there. Listen, we all get it wrong, don't we? Yeah. But I think this, when I think somebody once said a pastor, well, when we get squeezed, whatever's, we like tubes of toothpaste, we can be whatever we want to be on the outside. When we get squeezed, whatever's on the inside will come out. Mm. And quite often that physical exertion prepares us to be in such a way where by God's grace, through his scripture and Holy Spirit, when we are squeezed, even physically, we still respond in a godly, mm. in a godly way. And sport's a great way to condition that, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I'd agree. Good, great answer as well, by the way. I think that's hilarious. Better to give than to receive. Awesome. So from the outset, you've achieved your dreams. You've married your best friend, somebody who you've known since you were 14. You've got a family. You're part of a great community that you love and you've never left. On paper, your life must have looked perfect, yet you find yourself... how old were you when you became a Christian?
So it'd have been about 25.
So you're a young man, you've achieved your dreams, life must be good. What made you realise that what you'd achieved wasn't everything and there was so much more to life than medals and trophies and family and community?
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess it's the underlying foundation of the message you're trying to impress upon people. There's Proverbs 17, the crucible's for silver, the furnace for gold, but the Lord tests the hearts. It's really interesting when we talk about silverware, where we reward success in sport with gold medals, silver medals, bronze medals. And even now, I've got my first ever grand final ring. Got it on here, if you get to watch it. It's like one of those YouTube videos. And, that used to have 2004 inscribed on it, and I can't see the 2004 anymore because it's eroded. It's gone. Along with the erosion of the ring itself, a lot of the memories are starting to fade. And if I went out even into Rugby League world now and said, who won Grand Final in 2004? And who did they play against? You know, there'd be a small portion of people who'd remember. And the point being is that it don't last forever. It's entropic. It fades away. And again, from an Ecclesiastes point of view, it's meaningless. You know, it's not eternal. And so whilst there are some wonderful lessons to be learned on that journey of endeavour and striving, you know, thinking about resilience and fortitude, ultimately it's what your gaze is focused on eternally. I've got 8 grand final rings. I've got more losers medals as well, by the way. But they're indicative of an element that we pull out of the floor, put into a crucible or a furnace, we refine through heat and pressure, the dross is discarded, separated, contrasted, going back to that let there be light, bringing some kind of order to what is an impure chaos. What you're left with from a material point of view is quite a lasting, unrusting element. That's a great thermoconductor as well. It's too expensive to use in wiring, so we use copper instead. But actually, it will degrade. It's got a shelf life, and it's inert. It doesn't do anything. It's just an inert metal. But the Lord tests the hearts. And I think, again, as a metaphor, the physical metaphor, when we go through life, well, look at Book of Job, for example, probably the biggest, apart from Garden of Gethsemane, before Jesus goes to the cross. You've got the Book of Job, which I think is always a fascinating read, especially the first 2 chapters, going through all kinds of physical torture and hell and emotional torture on a mad scale that always keeps his gaze on questioning who is the mediator, who is God. And so the Lord tests the hearts in that we're tested, go through these lively trials, but we're always being refined by them if we can persevere and stay the course. So that's what I always try to impress upon people. It doesn't matter what I achieve. One day I'll close my eyes in this flesh for a long time, and what's important is what comes after that, you know, or who's after that. The medals are silverware, the memories, lovely. Loads of lessons to be learned. Learn them and then move on.
So who first introduced you to Jesus, and how did you first find yourself at your local church listening to the gospel?
There's a part of me always knew that, you know, the medals and silverware weren't going to last forever. And I did believe in something. The only, you ask people that question, oh, I believe there's something, I'm not sure what it was, and it's spiritual. And a guy called Ali Lauteti came to Leeds Rhinos in 2004, and he was a massive New Zealander, world class. And when he came in the same position as me, so I thought, oh no, this curtains for me. I'm still trying to break into the side on a regular basis. But it was obvious when he come quite early on that there's something different about the way he behaved, the way he thought. He wasn't a cantankerous young kid, kicking, screaming, fighting, biting, doing all wrong things, drinking, chasing wrong things as a young man. And he separated himself as and when that time needed. And everybody knew it was because of his faith. And you know, we loved that about him. And actually, in the training rooms in a working class sport, these boys have often come from humble backgrounds. And they don't tend to judge people's faith, let it get on with it. It is always been quite an inclusive sport. I know that's definitely not the case in many environments, but for me, it was an opportunity to ask a friend and a colleague what that meant. What does your faith mean? Will you teach me more? I've always been inquisitive, never understood it theologically. Interesting, I reflect now. My nana used to always say the prayers whenever she took me to bed as a youngster. She'd always finish by saying a prayer and praying for all her kids and praying to God that he'd look after us. And she would say, God's good. But we never went to church other than for formal events like weddings or christenings. So theologically, whilst I understood some of the Bible stories, you know, the nativity and Noah's Ark and those children things that we used to get taught at school back in the 80s, early 80s, I didn't know who Jesus was ultimately. So I asked Ali, he invited me along to the church, which was sitting evangelical. And this is a great story. The guy who was the pastor at the time, called Mike Wildsmith, And he took me under his wing. He was loved his cricket. He loved his sport. He grew up in Batley, but spent a lot of time in Liverpool. So became synonymous and connected to Liverpool Football Club as well through Bill Byagrose, who was the chaplain there. And he opened my eyes, pointed me to Christ Wars. We did the Christianity Explored course, which is Mark's Gospel. Rico Tyson, former Rebunion player, sort of narrated it. And then I started theologically to understand who Jesus was. And then in time, going to church, reading the Bible, doing the Bible studies, having those connections with him and other Christians in the church. You know, my eyes were opened, my heart and eyes were opened. The proverbial scales on the road to Damascus fell off, and I saw Jesus for the truth that he is, and life is illuminated then. And why that story is brilliant, amazing, is because now in his new role at the Rhinos, Mike Wildsmith, even though he was the guy who conducted the wedding and married me, herself, and my wife in 2008, he's been over Liverpool Warrington Way for last decade. But when the previous chaplain left, I invited him, said, look, mate, do you know anybody who might want to be a chaplain at Leeds Rhinos? And he's put his hand off. So he's come full circle and he's chaplain at the Rhinos now. So we're getting ready to do our Carols event. It'll be our third event, Edinley, where he comes and he's wonderful with that gospel truth and sharing that at a time when most people are accepting to at least hear him anyway. So I feel really blessed.
Awesome. Fantastic. So what do you think was more surprising to your friends and family, that you became a Christian or that you got an MBE?
I think, I've not asked that question. Interestingly, the faith bit of becoming a Christian was something I pursued, weren't looking for. I want to know the truth. I want to know who the truth is, the way, the truth and the life, and found it. By the good graces of God himself and some of the friends I surrounded myself with. The MBE was a fortuitous accident, interestingly enough. And I was in a very dark place. I was in a difficult time. I'd retired from playing. I was having to repurpose my identity. I did feel a bit of an imposter syndrome in this coaching role, all new to me. And I was struggling a bit. And this letter comes through post, and it's got HMP, some insignia on there. And when you live in Bramley and you get letters like that, it means you're going to court or maybe in prison. So I opened it and said, I'd been offered an MBE. Did I want to accept one? I'm like, wow, what an honour. What a wonderful moment in time and piece of recognition. But even that in itself, and it's wonderful going down, meeting Princess Anne, took my wife, me grandma, my mum. And it was a wonderful couple of days out. Because it wasn't something I set out to try and achieve, that quickly dissipates. There's a temporary happiness to it. I won't even say there's a fulfillment in it, because it wasn't ever a goal that I set out to achieve or any sort of lasting contentment. But it is nice, and it's just a reminder that, you know, people, secular or not, recognise those who do the best to bestow gifts upon other people. And I think that's an inert part of all of us, you know, in terms of being made in God's image. It's just helping everybody understand what the true source of love is and where it comes from.
It's interesting that somebody who had achieved so much personally with your family and professionally with your rugby, and then also with your faith, known who you were in Christ, suddenly finds himself in a dark place. And you mentioned imposter syndrome. Why do you think that's so common amongst many men, both in and out the church, and B, what do you think we need to do as Christians and as a church to help men be open about the struggles when they're in a dark place, and how can we support them? It seems that sport has a lot out there looking out for the welfare of the men within the game and the women in the game. But I found a few churches are a bit slow behind the pace at looking after the welfare of men. And often we don't share about our struggles within the church as often as we should.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. I think because we don't want to seem weak or out of control, you know, the very start of that question there, What about when you've got all this and that? Can you feel this way? I think it's the way I feel most days about certain things. And that's as a consequence of getting out of my comfort zone. I want to be careful in what I say here because I'm not a clinical psychologist by any means. And I would encourage everybody to speak. I mentioned earlier that seeing Paul Gascoigne get emotional as a young man almost made that okay for me. And I've been surrounded for a lot of my life with a lot of good people to be able to talk to, not least my wife. She's my best mate. So I've had a lot of people to talk to, and I've always been quite open to share some of those challenges with me. But I'd also say as well, that imposter syndrome is just as a phrase, you know, it's contextual, that, and ultimately what it means most of the time is that we're just feeling a bit uncomfortable about a certain scenario where we've been, what we've experienced. And I'm not so sure that that's not normal, by the way. I think, you know, we're not looking, certainly in scripture, you know, lamenting, anxiety, the way we think and feel is all part of us moving into a space that we've maybe never been before. Quite often, once we get there and we get stretched through support, and having, certainly as a Christian, that mindset of, I'm going to lay this at God's feet and just have that trust. I'm here through perhaps providence. I'm here in faith. And interestingly, as I've got older, somebody mentioned that. I went for a walk with a friend recently, and he used the word fear a lot. Mm. And I very rarely come across the word fear in my own reflections. I usually talk more about courage rather than fear. And I think it's because I'm looking that way, in the sense that stepping that way is going to be uncomfortable, rather than thinking about the fear that's chasing me, behind me. And so I have very little sort of spiritual fear anymore, because ultimately I know where I'm going to end up. There is an element of physical fear now and again. I get anxiety about going and running my intervals and try to get a certain time tomorrow. And all day I'm trying to hydrate and eat the right foods. And sometimes public speaking, you know, you got to get in front of a group of people. And my fear isn't what they might think of me afterwards. My fear is getting it wrong so I'm not helpful to them. And look, for most people, just get this around your head. And this, you know, social media's making this really prevalent. There's self-image and then there's self-esteem. And I think self-esteem is what you think of yourself when you look in the mirror. And I think that's the reflection you need to be most content with. You know, the self-image is what you think other people think of you through what they say about you online, perhaps, or on after a performance on television. Now, that bit is very difficult, if not impossible, to control. I would even go as far as to say it's none of our business. So don't worry about that. You know, there's ultimately four people and God at the centre of that, whose sort of material opinion I'm interested in. And they're all in this house and they love me a bit, right, unconditionally. There's, as far as I'm aware, there's six Jones Buchanans on this planet and they all live here. And I know that when I get here, regardless of whether the day's been amazing and I've got a grand final ring or an MBE, or I come home and I've been challenged all day, you know, they're here with love and care and a cuddle. And that's what we need to do. Those tribes, it's really important. We're part of a group, a church, a team. The challenge in 2024 is we're all part of multiple tribes, aren't we? And that's where we get confused, because they're not always congruent. But you know, at one point in history, it was pretty consistent, that moral anchor that drove any particular tribe and the values and behaviours. And when I say tribe, I'm just talking about community. Any community of up to, say, 80 people, would have had very similar values and behaviours. You might go to jiu-jitsu, then you might go to church, you might go to work, or you might go to a football game. And in each group where you identify as being a part of that group for a period of time, they could be very different. And then that's where anxiety comes around, because you start to question who you are and what other people think. And it's very hard to cross-pollinate different beliefs in those groups, which is the challenge, I think, for modern day society.
Yeah.
And what about church then, and your faith? You strike yourself as just naturally disciplined. When you've got a goal in, you're talking about doing a marathon now at what are you, 43? 40?
43, yeah.
43, yeah. So, and you're going to do your training tomorrow, and you're hydrating, you're looking after your diet, your drinks, your schedule. And how has that transferred into your faith life? Because being a Christian, we are called to be disciplined. Was that something that through your sport developed naturally amongst your faith, or has there been a struggle to transfer your discipline within the sport into your faith life?
Yeah, so sometimes people talk about discipline as if it's an acquired skill, and there's probably an element of that. And again, I'm not, I wouldn't be across the science. I would try and say that it's more routine. It's finding a routine and then sticking to it for such a time that it becomes just normal. And I think we're actually made up to be like that. And I think once we get into a certain routine and we're physically in sort of it's just in my experience. I haven't got is the gift of jumping at somebody else's body and understanding what the world looks and feels like. But for me, once I found the routine in my older age, and I needed that nexus between youth and wisdom, by the way, because as a professional sports person, I didn't have that discipline that I've got now because I didn't have the lived experience or the wisdom. But at the same time, I haven't got the physical ability as I had as a kid. I'm at 40, and you're sort of between maybe late 30s to early 50s. You're at this crossover where it's sort of damage limitation. But I found when I finished playing, I had two options. I could just eat what I wanted, do what I wanted, within reason. No, not to harm anybody else. But I thought, no, let's keep some clarity on what you're trying to do because I've still got things to give and places to serve. So if I want to do that, let's try and do it to the best of my ability. And just really simple things like I get up at the same time every day and I wake up regardless at the same time within a small margin of error without an alarm. I get up, I usually run at least 10K. I usually run. And listen, that isn't, you've got to remember, this isn't getting up and running around the streets like I'm training for a marathon every day. That's just being active. It could be a walk, you could take the dog, you could walk for a paper. You might just go put bins out, whatever. I get up, but I choose to run because I still can, I'm young enough. I compound that three times a week with doing it with my wife. So a lot of people, I haven't got time, I don't spend enough time. Well, there's 3 hours where I'm running at a very modest pace with my wife, and we're chatting about our children, we're chatting about our house, we're chatting about what the weekend looks like and our friends. So that's 3 hours that I get to spend with her. Whilst I'm doing something physically active, come back, I'm ready to win the day. In between that, waking up and going for my run, I read my Bible in such a way that I'll read it all inside a year. And so it's constantly going in. And listen, people will think, I'm going to have to make a load of notes and I'm studying. I'm not studying it. I'm not studying. I'll do that at another point. I'm reading it. And sometimes I'm really engrossed and it's really inspiring and it's really informative. And sometimes, right, I can't remember what I've just read because of whatever reason. But I'll guarantee it's in that subconscious. And my prayer is that when I'm making a decision at 1 p.m., that what I've read is there and it influences the decisions that I make and the direction I'm going. A really good example of that would be if I said to you now, I don't know if you've got a kettle in the house, but if you've got a kettle and it's on one side of the kitchen and I said to you, just go move it to the other side of the kitchen and leave it there for 3 days. The next time you walked in the kitchen, right, it'd take you maybe till maybe Thursday before you got out of a habit of walking to where it used to be. It's over there. And that's because, as far as I understand it, our brain is 2 or 3% of our body weight, yet uses 20% of energy. And it's constantly trying to make things habitual to a point where you just don't think about it. Driving is a great example. You know, you don't think about putting it in gear or clutch. You just drive. You can't even remember how you started and finished sometimes. That's what our brain does. So going back to you talking about discipline, if you can build a routine in life and be disciplined to create a process, the process will take you there. And I've got a very good process up to about midday. And then that's where I don't struggle, but that's where I've got some growth. And the reason being is because if I'm up at 5:15, I've read my Bible by 5:45, I'm out on the road running for 6, I'm back just before 7, depending on how far I'm going. Then I'm showered, I've sent a few emails, then I'm ready to join the rest of the world where 9 to 5 happens. And that's just madness. You're absolute chaos. because everybody's running around, sending emails, driving here, driving there, picking kids up, taking a dog for a walk. If I can do that before anybody else has got out of bed, then I'm in front. It's the finish of the day where I often struggle because I'm coming home and going, right, now I'll spend time with kids, have my tea, and I'm not one who likes going to bed. I get distracted. So that's discipline. Forging. There's a great book called Atomic Habits. I've read that, Compounding Time.
Oh, yeah, Small Steps. Yeah, I've read that. It's a good book. Yeah, it was helpful for my daughter who'd been with ill health. And again, you're rushing to get back to full fitness, but it's them tiny little steps, isn't it, that you need to put in place. Yeah, often where I fail is I want to lose a couple of stones, so I drop down to 500 calories a day for 6 weeks.
And how did you find it?
What the book?
No, did you say you dropped that 500 calories a day?
Oh, no. What I do is I go from one extreme to another. So I'll go from gorging to like really restrictive, and then I'm fine for a while, but then I fall off the balance. But when I'm doing it slowly and surely, and I have a treat, but I don't go crazy, that's when I tend to do the best. And it's the same with training. Because I enjoy the training, I'll go 4 times in a week and then put my back out, and then I can't go for another 3 weeks. So again, it's trying to be, I'd be better off going once or twice a week than still being fit and being able to do that regularly and consistent, then going 110%. And I've also found that in my spiritual life, where you said you've read the Bible in the year, then I saw a program, read the Bible in 3 months. I thought, that looks good, but it's about 15 chapters a day. And again, the first week you plod on and then you give up, and then you'd have been better off starting with the 3 or 4 chapters a day, doing it over the year.
Well, listen, yeah, and when you, I always put a tick at the end of each one.
Yeah.
And then after a certain amount of years, it's like compound interest. It's just there. And then I'll give you, so because I'm public speaking a lot, right? I said earlier, I see the world in abstract pictures. If somebody wants me to come and speak about a subject that I've not really spoken a lot about before, or I've got to construct it in a certain way, it takes an enormous amount of energy because I've got to memorize it in pictures, right? I've never been one that can write down bullet points on the paper to remind me. If anything, I take picture cards with me. But this become a limiting, it could become a challenge for me because I was being asked to host a lot of events, which meant reading out people's names. Some information might not get till I get there. So I thought, I have got to acquire the skill of being able to read out loud, not least because even if you're standing up in a church sometime, you've got to stand up and read a passage. I wasn't comfortable doing it, even though I can stand in front of a television camera with potentially millions of people on BBC. So when I was reading the Bible, I started reading it out loud as well, which brought about a multitude of other benefits, not least other people that are walking past and listening, the family in the house. And also, it sticks because you're physically doing it and you're using your muscles. It's there, it's stuck to you. And I'll tell you really quick, if I was to write behind me now, right, I had a bit of chalk and you asked me to write a sentence, I've been worried about the spelling. I've never been great at spelling. If you ask me to type it out, I seem to type it really well. I very rarely get spelling wrong. So that different skill acquisition brings about a different outcome. And I define that when I'm reading it every day. And sometimes, like I said, you can't always go back and go, well, how's that going to steer me this afternoon? Inevitably, when the semantic links come, somebody asks me a question, what do you think about this? Or you see something on the news, what do you think about that? Straight away, that it's almost like that matrix stuff coming down. And it's like, there's scripture, it's there. It's on my heart, it's written on our hearts. We just need to liven it, yeah, just keep it there as part of the process. Mm. And it is spiritual, right? You know, I'm making it sound very practical. And it's spiritual, it's in the heart. It comes through the spirit and prayer. But, you know, there's a reason why we read our Bibles and we're trusted with it. I think, you know, of all the speaking I do, the pulpit is the most terrifying place because that's the place where you least want to get it wrong. You know, it's got to be absolutely who and what you're representing there is so important.
And again, that's what Jesus did, didn't he? He just read the scriptures continuously over and over again. And that's what the early church did before everyone could read, or it was in it, we heard it. We were a lot of us learned orally, didn't we, just by hearing other people speaking it out loud. And although we didn't have the verses and the numbers, I think there's something in that, isn't it, that the Lord gives us practical gifts to learn spiritual.
Language is massive. The ability to convey information through different means. And if you think based on your theory there, that how long, well, it's truth, not theory, you know, how long have the majority of human beings in society been reading for? A lot of it has become oral. Yet reading is such a profound thing. It's real. It's there. And it's so important in another method through which the conveyance of information is travelling this way. There's lots out there that talks about public speaking, for example. People want to know, how do I get better at public speaking? There's a guy on YouTube who's like a master at it. And he was saying, it's really interesting, he's got a TED Talk on public speaking, and then he's got another one on listening, right? And there's a profoundly more exaggerated number of people listening to the speaking bit than the listening, but yet the listening is the most important part of being a good speaker, right? So, you know, the way we assimilate knowledge is just, it's fascinating.
Yeah, well, have you read the book How to Think?
No. Come with the next one.
Fantastic book, because we've forgotten the art of thinking. So, again, that's to do with because we don't listen. We often, we will, if somebody says something and we don't like the word or the tone or the sentence, we just switch off. That's it. And this guy is talking about a famous basketball player who we looks at motives and how we, what one person will think is rational, it's irrational to somebody else. But if we understand the mind of the person, we can then see why what he's doing is rational. So there was a basketball player who, I forget his name, but he had the best returns from the way he shot. He was the best scorer within the NBA. But his teammates used to mock him for throwing the ball effeminately. So he changed his style. He scored less baskets, but he was still the leading scorer. And people thought that was an irrational move, that he would lose so many points. But his motive wasn't to be to get the best points. It was to have more women follow him. So he didn't want to be seen as effeminate. He wanted to be seen as masculine. So it was rational to him to lose the points because he would look more masculine to his teammates and to females. Wow. And again, often that was just shown us, if we listen to people, we get to understand them, and then we can relate to how they're thinking.
Absolutely. Yeah. And imagine that story times 10 people, with a slightly nuanced intent or desire. You know, everybody would assume, oh, he wants to score more baskets. I was with the group from Pretoria last week. I don't know if I told you this. There was a doctor. He was an academic doctor. And I was telling him something very similar. When you're in a group of people in an organisation, you can say one thing somewhere, something else, and getting everybody to follow is really difficult. And he said, as a doctor in his communities, in South Africa, he can ask a group of people to wash their hands, right? Please wash your hands. If you want to get rid of this illness, wash your hands. He said about a third of people will listen to him. If you ask the local priest to come and tell them to wash their hands, they'll all do it. Now, that's cultural and contextual as well. Ask that same question, different country, you might get the reverse. But it goes to say that the fact is one thing, whether you're right or wrong, but then who, what, how and where and when you say it is a completely different thing. Mix that up by 10 different people. You're a coach, head coach. You think you're saying something positive to three of them. You've just upset another 10. Nah, it's all over shop. But again, you know, give us this day on the bread, going back to reading. It's just about bringing in that knowledge, either through spoken words, contact with other Christians, reading your Bible. It's a blessing.
Awesome. Oh, Jeremy, it's been absolutely fascinating chatting with you. I really appreciate your time. I know you're busy and you've come home to see your family. So I'll let you go, but I really appreciate your time, and I do wish you well for your new role within Leeds Rhinos, and yeah, I hope that we can speak again at some time in the future.
Well, you've got my details, you've got my email. Come and see us down at Rhinos. Let me know when you come in, and I'll show you around. I'll show you around some of the changing rooms, and yeah, it's great. Thank you for inviting me to share. It's always a privilege to talk about Jesus and the first fruits of an eternal hope and looking forward to an eternal life with him at some point.
Awesome. Oh, brilliant. Thanks very much, brother.
Cheers, Paul. Keep smiling.
I will do, brother.